Thank you for the beautiful singing of the Epiphany proclamation. Long-standing custom that on this feast day, going back to days before there were lots of printed things, calendars, before there were iPhones and Apple Watches and stuff was everywhere to tell time, you rang out the calendar of the coming year's feasts. So Ash Wednesday, Easter, Corpus Christi, Advent this coming. So because Jesus is Lord of all time in the whole year and of all the nations. So it's a wonderful way to ring in his feast today. So thank you for that. Epiphany celebrates this interesting story in Matthew's gospel. Only Matthew has it. And it's among the most mysterious and kind of interesting and sort of captivating scenes in all four gospels. It's kind of a cool, odd, strange, mysterious, beautiful story. These kings show up and they worship the newborn king, right? As a feast, it is actually older liturgically than Christmas, so it's even more important than Christmas on one level, so lots to talk about in it. How does one unpack it? Maybe today, to say, of course, as I always say, thousands of things, let's pick this direction, a little comment about or a theory about who these guys possibly were historically, maybe. We don't know, but maybe. From that, how the church has picked it up in a devotional sense with a manger scene like we have in the back. And from those two things, how does it draw all of us in? How does it impact us, especially in our homes today, right? Who were they, these magi, these mysterious travelers from the East, as Matthew says about them? Many people think that the obvious candidate is that to the far east of Judea, in modern-day Iran and Iraq, would have been the remnants of the Persian peoples, who would have been adherents, by and large, of a faith called Zoroastrianism, which meant lots of things about kind of heavenly bodies and deities and spirits and whatnot, but at the kernel of their whole system was a careful watching of the stars, of the heavenly bodies. And some of them thought of them as heavenly deities. They were gods in their own right. We think of them as planets. For them, they were divine creatures who had powers on earth that corresponded to how they moved in the heavens. Big star is born in the heavens. Somebody important must be born on the earth, so they sometimes thought. Maybe these guys came from that far away. That would be a little bit of a hike, but could be done in those days. Another theory that I've heard, which actually seems to be a little more credible to me, would go kind of like this. Right to the east of Judea in present-day Jordan, so not too far away, and east and south in present-day Yemen, all these little kingdoms kind of were around the Judean kingdom, led by different people, different empires, nationalities, with different faith backgrounds. And in many of their cases, they too were quite interested in star observation and worship, so astronomers, let's say, for religious purposes, so they charted the heavens. These kingdoms had trade ties, merchant exchanges with Judea, especially with King Herod, who had grown at this point now, let's call the 7 BC on a more accurate calendar, very powerful in his territory. And so there were trade routes between these kingdoms up through Bethlehem, Judea, and to the Mediterranean coast, and they went caravans across these routes all the time. What seems perhaps the case, maybe, is that watching the stars, it seems to be the case that in 7 BC there was something of a charted, historically documented alignment of Jupiter and Saturn, or maybe a supernova, who knows, something bright that caught their attention, which caused these guys to move toward Jerusalem, thinking, well, this must be the birth of the Judean king, which must be Herod's grandson. Herod's the king. He must have had a grandson. The next ruler has been born. And since we are trade partners with him, it's a good idea to go and pay him a visit. And let's bring with us our national commodities, gifts from one ambassador to a royal court. And so they got on their trade routes through Bethlehem up to Judea, get to Herod's palace and say, "Where is he? Where is your grandson, the next ruler?" He says, "I have no idea what you're talking about," as gospel clearly makes plain. They search the scriptures. They find it in Micah's prophecy. Oh, Bethlehem is the birth of the Judean kings. You went past it. Go back. It's on the way. Back, these travelers would have come. We don't know how many there were. And probably in Bethlehem, which was a tiny little town, they would have made inquiries about any unusual new births. And of course, there's probably only one in a city like that. Happened upon the house, as Matthew says, of Mary and Joseph. And there they came and found the child, as Matthew describes it. And then they did something remarkable. Not a palace, not Herod's descendant. This mysterious, unique, humble child, in combination of the star, God's divine providence, and their own encounter with the newborn Jesus, moved them to do him worship. They entered the house. They did him worship, as in, like, this is a deity. They thought of him as a god. And they offered him their commodities, their national products. Gold from Yemen, or back then Sheba, which they mined in Ethiopia in huge quantities, which we know. And frankincense and myrrh were like cash crops for the people of the current day Jordanian kingdom. So the Midians, or the Nebateans, as they were called. This would have been what you give to a new ruler from your own home country. If we were to go to, you know, say Europe, we bring with us, you know, cheese or something, right? So same idea. Here's some gold, here's some cash crops. Have a nice day, right? They go home by another way because they're so moved by the experience, their lives have become altered accordingly. Speculation. We don't actually know, but it's not a bad theory based on products, trade routes, commodities, astrology. It just kind of all sort of would fit the circumstances. Maybe, maybe, maybe. Why on earth does Matthew care? Luke does not put this story in his gospel. It's just not part of his storyline. Mark is silent on the birth of Christ, period. John has a whole different way of talking about it. But for Matthew, he really wants this story in there. He's like, oh yeah, I got to get that. That event is important to understanding Jesus. So he picks it up and he puts it in his narrative, right? Why? As you understand, I think, these foreign visitors were not Jews. They were pagan. They were Gentiles. They were outside the boundaries of the established chosen people, which meant that by God's providence and God's truth, how Matthew sees the star, they were led to the people of Jerusalem, the nations coming to the Jewish people to find salvation, and by their own twists and turns and scripture references, wound up doing homage, worshiping as outsiders, as foreigners, as non-Jews. They worshiped the newly born Messiah. As Matthew sees his entire gospel storyline, and we'll get this throughout the coming year, in year A now, it's very important to make the point that Gentiles and Jews can worship together the newborn king. They're not excluded. Salvation has spilled over the borders of the customary boundaries of the people, so that now God can welcome the worship of everybody and every nation. And beyond that, Matthew sees in their gifts not just national commodities and cash crops, which they would have been, incense, frankincense, myrrh, gold. They are gifts befitting of His Majesty the Child. Gold for a real king. Was he not a real king? Of course, Matthew says. Who gets myrrh? People who are going to die, they're buried with it. This child is a sacrifice. In some mysterious way, this becomes clear in this exchange of commodities. Incense for the halls of a king or for an altar of offering and sacrifice, like the child will be one day on the cross. So Matthew sees it all come together. And beyond that, as Matthew sees it, the heavenly bodies that move around, Jesus' birth is a cosmic event. In some way, as Matthew sees it, not only does Christ's coming restore human nature to glory, it restores the cosmos. He's at the center of the universe. The stars obey him. The waters of the earth obey him. The birds of the sky obey him. Matthew says, in this child is the renewal of all creation, and the heavens speak to his reality. So in Matthew's narrative, this story gets it right off and running for our first evangelist, St. Matthew. That's why he's got it all in there. He loved the story. Obviously, it wouldn't have been in his gospel. What does that have to do with us? Different things, maybe now you're kind of getting where I'm going, but to bring it home a little bit, we'll add on top of the historical layer one extra layer of what I call devotional piety that has grown up over the centuries around this story. And it's probably the part that we are more customarily familiar with because of nativity scenes, okay? We have a lovely nativity scene here, a manger scene in the back by the doors of our church. You walk by it all the time, right? For so many years and so many people, that's how one knows the story. It's not exactly this story, but it builds on the essential parts of it. So in the, I think it was 7th century, I want to say it was, so 600s is when they kind of codified this and it became custom and devotional art. It goes like this. If you're going to depict this gospel like we know it, you have to have three kings, even though there's not actually three in the story, but one for each gift. That's how we got to three of them. And they all have their gift in hand, the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh. There they are. And then it became customary to say not only must there be three, there must be a different nations. There's a dark-skinned king, there's an oriental-skinned king, and a white king from Europe, the Orient, and Africa, at that time the known world. All the nations are in this image. And not only that, one must be beardless, as in young. One must have a brown beard or a middle-aged beard. And one must have an old, long beard to represent the three ages of man: youth, middle age, and old age. You can argue which one you're in, okay? But in the depiction of them in our scene, ours is actually not quite that close. Ours is a little off the customary one. But if you have a classical manger scene, what I described to you is on it. Go home, look at your mantletop. Oriental, African, European, the known world, different ages, and their gifts representing their own collective peoples. The point is, the church has it as an art form and as a gospel and as a feast every year because, like Matthew was trying to say, those kings represent every single one of us. They are our figures. They are our symbolic markers in the story. Not only were they historical tradesmen, perhaps, but they are the bearers of a reality that is tremendously, tremendously good news. It is that every single one of us, regardless of continent, language, nation, background, we all have equal access to the truth of the gospel. It can be proclaimed on every continent, in every language, in every circumstance. And if a person is paying any attention, they will leave behind their mistaken ways of thinking, they'll hang on to what's true in their ways of thinking, and they'll come to the full truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ, who is Messiah and Lord, not just of the Jews, not just of the Italians or the Germans or the Africans, but of everybody, everywhere, all time, all ages, period. That's why this feast is so ancient. It actually kind of trumps Christmas on the old calendars. Because the church realized this is really the first instance when we spilled out everywhere and the whole world discovered the new Christ, not just the Jews, but now everybody. This is a controversial point these days. It's kind of smacks against the pluralism we're used to, that everybody's got their own truth and every religion is right. The feast says, no, not quite. Christ is the truth. He is the guiding star of humanity. He is the way. He is the Messiah, the only way to the Father. And the good news of that is that everybody's got access to him. Everybody can know him, believe him, love him. I mean, how wonderful, think about that, how wonderful is that? God excludes no one who wants to learn the truth. It's beautiful. Practically speaking, therefore, for us today, right? So since we've established by gospel history and piety of the manger scene that we are all in the story, those magi represent every single one of us, what does that mean for us exactly? It means every single era, every one of us here, must copy their behavior. What do? Important things. Matthew says, one, they enter the house of the Holy Family. He calls it a house, no stable for Matthew. They go into the dwelling place of God. They live in God's house. They enter the house of God. To do that, if you unpack that, is to decide that they're going to conform their lives to the one who lives there. It means that all of us, in entering the house of God in baptism and the sacraments and hearing the gospel, make the decision to make God's house our house. That means that our little homes, that we'll go back to our little mini places of God's dwelling, where his law reigns supreme, where we practice his teachings, where we live by his example, where we offer forgiveness to each other when we mess up, where we raise our kids in the gospel values, where we take care of the sick and the poor and the vulnerable. We conform our houses to the house that we want to inhabit as the Lord's. So as the Magi ourselves, we are in the manger scene. I just explained how. We all say, yes, I make God's house my house. I enter it and I live by his values, his teaching, his principles. Not only that, they worship him and they give him gifts. Enter the house, worship, give gifts. We worship him too. Certainly that means here at Mass, of course, but around the supper table, at bedtime prayers, on the way to work, praying in the car. We worship him when we decide to place our own gospel values and commandments higher than the secular, let's call them pulls of our modern world. We say, God comes first. I worship him alone. Everything else is secondary. Everything else in the world has a place, and it can be good, but only to the extent that it lines up with God's order of things. That's what reigns supreme. So to worship means not only to come to the altar like we do this morning, but to let this translate into an ordering of our priorities about all that we do, all that we do. And we give him gifts, right? In their case, national commodities, which happen to correspond as identity. In our case, we offer our prayers, we offer our time, we sacrifice for our kids and our spouses, for our country, for our values, for priorities, for our parish, for our ministries, for the community of West Bend and beyond. We say, I'm not going to live for myself. I will live for the good of other people and offer. I will offer, I will offer, I will offer. And the gesturing of offering will find happiness and joy that only generosity can bring. That's why you put money in the basket, okay? That's why you raise kids, which is a tremendous sacrifice and a beautiful one. That's why you support organizations and causes and scouts and this and that. I mean, it's you're saying, I place my gifts at the service of the greater good. I don't hang on to them. They're not mine. So as the Magi, the modern Magi, here we are, the modern Magi, we do what they did. Enter God's house, live by his law, worship him, give him all that we have. And then finally, they go back by another way. We leave here today hopefully changed because we encountered on the altar the newborn king. And we don't go back the same. We live differently. We live hopefully more joyfully, intentionally, with the risen king alive in our hearts that he gives us off the altar at Mass in the Holy Eucharist. What a gift he gives back to us for all the gifts that we give to him. He gives us still the greatest gift of himself. On we can go, right? Beautiful, beautiful layers in the feast day. So as a historical event, it does kind of work, depending on how you put it together. It's certainly in the gospel. That means it's part of our faith. It's in our manger scenes at home because it's all of us. And because it is, we can be saved. Non-Jews that most of us probably are, even we can do homage to the true God who actually bows down before us in the Holy Eucharist. God is great. May he be praised on this beautiful feast day.